Okay, thanks a lot. So the first talk of the afternoon session, so I guess more people are enjoying the lunch break still, but we have to go on. So I'm going to talk about research that we've been conducting in collaboration with these two guys, George Periotakis and Vrits Mudgil from the Particle Engineering Research Center, with my advisor Dr. Pardalos and with Mario from Italy, and it's related to data mining approaches applied in Raman spectroscopy for cell depth discrimination. So first, I will put an introductory slide, and I guess you should look at the left screen. With the main problem, so we care about clustering supervised and unsupervised, about feature selection, about semi-supervised, about biclustering that we had several talks in the morning. And biomedical informatics, they are good about for these applications because we have lots of data and lots of problems. In this presentation, we're dealing mostly with the feature selection and with the supervised classification. So this is another slide I like to put at the beginning of my presentation with Fisher to remind people that one of the first data miners, as we would call him today, he was both statistician and life scientist. He was eugenetist, and he understood the idea of at the same time acquiring data and on the other side analyzing the data and provide algorithms that would be able to automatically discriminate flowers in his case. And today his IRIS dataset is in all data mining repositories, and it's a good example for data mining classes. So in the classification is the supervised case of learning, where we have a phase of training that we have some data, we train our model, and then we classify some unknown data, and then we measure in the testing we measure how good is this classification, and then we go back and we train and so on and so forth until the student graduates. And of course there are several such methods. We talked about support vector machines, that they have very strong connection to convex optimization. Some other nearest neighbor techniques and naive Bayes classification. Another method that we're going to be using here is the so-called generalized eigenvalue classification that has a very neat formulation, and there are some other heuristic methods which are artificial neural networks that are mostly beloved in the field of computer science when optimizers really hate them. So feature selection, on the one side, is important for computational wise. So computationally, we want to have less features so that we boost the and then we have smaller feature sizes, and then our algorithms run faster. On the other side, application wise, the biologists or the clinical scientists or the life scientists, they care to know which features are the important, because these features most probably have some application related interpretation. And of course, to find how they are related with the biology and the chemistry behind the numbers. So here we used the case study that we're examining is Raman spectroscopy. So what we have, it's cells. So we have human cells, cancer, and we have this Raman spectrometer. So the basic principle of spectrometry is just throwing a beam of light, and then the light is reflected, and depends on where the beam hit, proteins, lipids, or in which part of the spectrum, it's gonna create a peak. So what happens over here, up there, that's the Raman shift, which is mapped here. So every peak corresponds to some different material that is included in the cell, and this is the how a spectrometer looks like, the experimental setup. So I don't know to tell you a lot about the experimental state of the problem, since the experiments were not conducted by us but by our colleagues, but mostly, so for this experiment, we had some A549 cells. So you can order cells online with some specific cancer. So these are lung epithelial cells. And so if you put it under the microscope, you're going to see something like that. So these cells, can be treated with some substances, so that they are grown in some crystal for several days, and then they are treated with some substances, and then we want to see what's the effect on these substances in these cells, and to see if these cells can be killed with a certain substance. Okay. So, what can we get from Raman spectroscopy? So we can get information about the DNA and RNA, and we can get information about the lipids, and we can also get information about the proteins. So these are the most important parts that one cell constitutes of. So and this information comes in the form of peaks. So that's a Raman spectrum. That's a Raman shift spectrum that we get. And we know from the literature that every of these peaks corresponds, let's say, to RNA or to DNA. So if we localize the, if we say, for example, that the two classes, the discrimination between two classes is because of the change in a specific area of the spectrum, we can go back and localize the mechanism of activity which is responsible for the discrimination. Okay. So in our case, we had three classes. So the first class, and actually these are all the data plotted on top of each other, and I did it on purpose to see that there is some overlapping and they're not like visually distinguishable. So we had control cells, which is cancer cells without any treatment, and we had some cells treated with etoposide. Etoposide is a very strong drug, a poison that causes the cells to die with apoptotic way, and then some other cells that they were treated with Triton X. Triton X is another substance that causes the cells to die with another way of dying, a necrotic way. Okay, so and these are our three classes, and we had about 30 cells from each class, and in such way, if we can build a classifier model based on these examples that we know the death type, apoptotic, necrotic, or no death at all, we can use we can assess the some effects in some unknown cells. So let's say that we want to try one drug, we give it to the cells, and then we take the Raman spectrum, and based on this model we can see where they can be classified, if they're still alive or if they died necrotic or apoptotic. Okay, so advantages and disadvantages. The Raman spectrum, that's for the method of Raman spectroscopy. So it's a little bit, it's nice because, for example, it's not affected by the water, so we can do the analysis in environment with water. So you don't perturb the biochemistry, and it's an in vivo, and it's also non-destructive. So non-destructive means that we don't have to destroy our cells, so we can do Raman spectroscopy and then keep using the cells for some other purpose. On the other side, the problem is that the most important problems are over here, and they have to do with the data analysis. So this one is the background radiation, that actually there are very good methods. It's not actually a limitation. It can be eliminated by finding the background spectrum in a material, and then we can just delete it. The most basic problem is the peak deconvolution. So as I told you, these spectrums, they are formed out of peaks. And for example, this peak over here is a convolution of 9 peaks. So if you want to quantitatively analyze peak by peak this data, you have to deconvolve the 9 peaks. And as you can see, it should be a problem that doesn't have only one solution. So it's an underdetermined problem, and then find where these peaks are, and then compare them and do statistical analysis. So in order to analyze one such sample, you need manually to go and take one spectrum, do the fitting, find the area under the peak, do the comparison, do the statistical analysis, and then write the paper. So that's not a very efficient way. So we're trying to find something faster. Okay. And of course, in order to discriminate between two spectra, you know, you need, you have values for all the peaks, and have many samples. So you need multivariate methods. You cannot just do a comparison and be done with the discrimination. So what happened is that first I'm going to describe one an earlier work that was conducted also in our lab that we use support vector machines. Okay, not we in our lab. I was not in part of this research at the time. And we took the pairs, or each two classes, and they discriminate them. And then they used the distance from each cell to the separating hyperplane, so that you see, you know, in which class it belongs to. And then, in order to assess some new cells that they were heated, so that some other cells that we just heated them, we wanted to see in which class they belong, and we used the support vector machine classifier. So support vector machines, as many people discussed today, is a way based on margin maximization that we have two classes, and we want to find which are the two support vectors that, or which is the separate hyperplane that separates optimal the data. We can formulate it as an optimization problem. So we choose the one that maximizes the margin, and the line in the middle is the separation hyperplane, and it can be formulated as a convex optimization problem, and there are very fast methods. And it's for two classes. Okay, so the support vector machines, they have some multi-class generalization in terms of voting. So what you have, if you have n classes, you usually find the separating hyperplane between all two pairs of classes, and then you classify one sample in all the classifiers, and at the end the classifiers vote, and you can assign the sample in the class that most classifiers set. But instead of this, we used another method called generalized classification method. So here are the results from this first paper. So it was the classifier control versus a toposite. So these are the first six samples. And then the heating were the unknown. So in the first classifier, they were classified as apoptotic. In the second one, which was control versus necrotic, they were half and half, which means that most probably they don't belong in each of the two classes. And here we're classified both as apoptotic. So that this result, you know, we concluded that they died in an apoptotic way if you hit the if cells are hit. Okay, so here we use the generalized eigenvalue classification, which actually Mario described it very well before the lunch break. So what we have two classes. Instead of having one hyperplane in the middle, we have one hyperplane for each class. And each hyperplane has the property that it has the minimum distance from all the points of the same class, and the distance is maximum with the points of the other classes. And the good thing about it is that it can be described as a generalized eigenvalue problem. So we can just solve this generalized eigenvalue problem, and the solution is the omega and gamma that give us the hyperplanes. And then okay, so that's the derivation of the method that Mario discussed also earlier, that we all have to solve this problem. And then when one new point comes, we assign it to the distance. Okay, so we find the distance from the two classes, from the two hyperplanes, and it's assigned to the class which is closer. Okay, and the good thing about this method is that it can be generalized. So it can be generalized when we have many classes, because now we don't have just a hyperplane which divides the two classes, but we have one hyperplane for each class. So once we find the hyperplane for each class, then we can have one point here, and we can find the minimum distance and assign to the class that we like. So how it generalizes exactly? So what happens is that over here, if you've seen the previous slide, the problem, we put the data matrix on the numerator of the one class and the data matrix of the other class in the denominator. So When we have n classes, we can either go with two options. We can either consider all the other classes as the second class, so we can we can find the regex versus this one class to be this and another class to be all the others. So we find one hyperplane and then this one against all strategy. Or what we can do is that we can find one hyperplane, one this against this, this against this, and this against this. We find three hyperplanes, and then we can do singular value decomposition to find the mean hyperplane that characterizes this class. So that's how the method generalizes into the multi regularized generalized classification. Yes, sure. K, you mean the number of classes?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about supervised classification. So we're given the number of classes and several examples from each class that we know, and based on them we build the model, and then we classify the unknown set. Yeah. Yeah, it's. It's over here, so you find this distance, which is this one, over this distance, and you classify it to the closest. And actually, the original version of this algorithm was proposed by Mangasarian, and the modification that there is in multi-regex is just about the regularization way, the way to regularize. So yeah. This is a verbal. Oh, the red does not look very nice in this background, but okay. So we have k classes, compute k planes, and the average hyperplane is the one found by the singular value decomposition. Okay, so this is the multi-regex algorithm, and on top is actually the actual regularized term that we use. So that's because sometimes without regularization we have some problems related to eigendecomposition, and the eigenvalues might not be finite, so we need to do the regularization. And lately we have discovered that this regularization make the problem a little bit more robust. So if we add noise to the original data and we use the regularized version, it performs better than. Okay, so that's how it works. So if a new point comes, we find the distance from the four hyperplanes, and we assign it to the class. And of course, you can use the kernel version. So third time today, so it's not a trick anymore; it's a method. So and usually you use RBF kernel. Now feature selection. Feature selection in our case. What does it mean? Of course, we want to reduce our problem, to solve the same problem with less features. Also, and there are several ways to do it. Here, we decided to do it somehow different, and the intuition was based on the following observation. So we took all the features, we took all the samples, and we found the correlation between the samples. And we saw this, okay? And we said, wow, these features are very correlated. They're highly correlated, meaning that they tell very similar story about the problem. So we don't need them. We need less. And once we find some features that they are representative for the problem, we can go back and see what do these features mean. Where are the proteins, are the lipids, and how they are related with death cell. So yeah. And the way we try to approach this is by using spectral clustering. Spectral clustering is a method that is based on the old graph equipartition problem, and it consists in partitioning one network. So what we did was we considered all the features, every feature as being a node, and one edge to be the correlation between two features. So we have a network. And then we wanted to cluster this network. And based on the clusters, to derive a rule and select a subset related to the clusters that would characterize our problem and use it in the classifier. So we used spectral clustering. So in spectral clustering, what we do, we form a matrix, the adjacency matrix of our problem, Wij, where Wij, at every entry, we have the correlation between the IF and the JF feature. And we don't compute the correlation for the same feature, so it's one for I equals J. And in order to find the balanced clustering of the network, we can relax this problem and solve it just by one eigendecomposition. So what happens is that we form the normalized matrix of the system, or sometimes we form another matrix, which is the Laplacian matrix that is related to this one. So we form the volume matrix, which is the capital D. And the capital D matrix is a diagonal matrix that in every II position has the volume for the ith node. So it's the sum over all i's. And then we use this volume matrix in order to normalize the adjacency matrix. And this normalized adjacency matrix can be shown that the eigendecomposition of this matrix is the solution to the spectral clustering problem, of the relaxed version of the spectral clustering problem. So there was an algorithm by NG, Jordan, and Weiss in 2001 that tells just take W hat, find the eigenvectors that they correspond to the k lowest eigenvalues, and then apply some clustering method in it, some k-means, some clustering method, and these clusters, you know, they correspond to the original problem clusters. So what we did is that we found the three eigenvectors that they correspond to this algorithm, and we embedded the nodes in this space, and here we colored these every node with the value of the correlation, so with a numerical value from this matrix. So yeah, and then we applied k-means on the eigenspace, and that's the clustering that we found. Okay, so there are five clusters. That's just an example for k equals five. In our algorithm, we repeated it for many k's. And then for every cluster, we found the average connectivity, the inter-cluster connectivity. And we select the subset of features that would represent our data set, the cluster, with the smaller number of connectivity. Okay, so actually here it says I select is the arg mean of SI, where SI is the connectivity in every cluster. So we did it, and that's the algorithm how to compute the clusters and how to do the selection. And then we use these features in order to train and evaluate the generalized eigenvalue classification. So without the feature selection, we had about 92.22% plus minus 9.5. And with the feature selection, we had 97. And we did the hold down cross validation, and that's where the p-values come from. And we repeated, I think, 100 times or 1,000 times, but a large number so that we can be statistically sure that we are not fooled by randomness. Okay, and then what we did, we repeated the same experiment by varying the size of the training set. So we said that we're going to do the cross-validation using 90% as training and 10% as testing, and here 80% as training and 20% as testing, and so on and so forth. And the blue line is the accuracy of the algorithm if we use the spectral feature selection algorithm. The red line is if we use all the features. And the gray dotted line is if we use a random number of features which is equal to the selected features. So just say that our algorithm selected 100 features, select 100 random features, and do the classification. And that's the result we got, which it's shown that the blue line is the combination of regex and feature selection algorithm seems to do better. And here is the consistency of the feature selection. So we did 100 cross-validation times, and at every time, this histogram means that the feature with index 1760, actually this is not feature index, but it's converted into Raman shift, it was chosen 97 or 98 times. So these are for 100 runs, how many times the same features were selected. So we see some consistent area in the spectrogram, from ranging from 1750 to 1800. And then we said, okay, what's that? What does this mean with respect to the spectrum? And we went in the literature and we found that at this area there is this CO bond that is usually related to the lipids and the lipid bilayer that exists in the cell membrane. And what happens is that during the necrotic death, the cell is lysing, so the lipid bilayer dissolves in the cell membrane. And during the apoptotic death, it does not lyse, but it changes conformation. Okay, so we said that that's most probably the one of the, it's a factor that changes during the death, and that's why the discriminatory effect, if we take only this part of the spectrum, is higher. So yeah, so these are our collaborators. So as I told you, we work with the Particle Engineering Research Center at the University of Florida. That it's Dr. Britt Mudgill who's directing the center, and he's doing lots of activities over there. Our other collaborators were George Periotakis, the one who's responsible. He was postdoc responsible for the Raman project. Unfortunately, now he joined the Greek army, so we're gonna miss him. And this is Michael Fenn, who recently joined the group, and we're working currently with him on a new project on new data discrimination. And of course, we developed these algorithms with Dr. Pardalos and with Mario from Naples, Italy. And now, okay, I'll just want to conclude the talk. How much time? Yeah, I want to conclude the talk by describing some of the future research that we're planning to do with this method. So now we want to keep using data mining methods in order to assess and evaluate some new cancer treatment. So these guys in this center, actually what they do is that they construct some micro molecules that they want to use them as cure for cancer. And in order to assess the results, okay, in large scale, so they can take the data, but then the analysis takes a lot. So we want automatically to being able to discriminate and to select features and say that these two things, they are discriminated between this part of the cell. So and thus, you know, find some biological strong conclusions. So now, what they're doing, they have some micromolecules, the surfactants, that these are some, they're called wetting agents, and they are composed out of a hydrophilic head and a hydrophobic tail, and they can interact with the cell membrane. So what they do is that when they are in a water environment, which is like the cell environment is, they try to go inside the cell membrane and sometimes they call cell death because they interact with the cell membrane. The thing is that you can, or maybe they can design a surfactant with different properties, and thus out of the several surfactants, because you can change many things and construct a new surfactant, they want to decide which one is best for cancer. The one that, which one can destroy the cancer cells and leave the healthy cells intact. Okay, and that's how the surfactants look like. And our goal is to assess this curing effect and help them to find the best one. So this, if you know some basic biology, this might well remind you of the cell membrane structure, that you have some head which is hydrophilic, that likes water, and hydrophobic, that doesn't like water. So they try to hide. So in a cell environment, they will eventually interact with the cells and the cell membrane. Okay, so these are some references. So this is the first paper where we worked on that, the one that I described to you now, and the other paper is available online, related support vector machines, and these are more literature about generalized eigenvalue classification. So thank you, and can take questions. Usually it's MATLAB, yeah, MATLAB, and as far as I know, it uses LAPACK algorithm inside. So, yeah, all these implementations that we're using, we use MATLAB because it's fast.
Yes, I'm not familiar with this Mangasarian wild. Mm-hmm. I just tried to look it up, but I couldn't find it. But is the idea that you have two clusters and you basically find a plane that goes
Yeah, not of the middle. Let me go back to the slide. Okay, so this is the case. Instead of finding, like support vector machines, the plane that goes through, we find one plane which is which the points of this class, if we sum all the distances, it's minimum, and the distance from this point is maximum. So we minimize the inter-class points and we maximize the intra class points, and this can be casted. So yeah, so that's the distance formula. So A is the one, A and B are the two classes, A and lost B. So A and W minus E gamma is the hyperplane. So that we maximize this and we minimize this, so it can be easily transformed into this generalized eigenvalue problem. And he drops, actually what makes this problem even easier is that he drops the assumption that these two hyperplanes have to be parallel. So you don't have to be parallel. So it makes the problem much easier.
Yeah, it
was here. I promise. Okay, let me.
Yeah.
No, that's my Mac. Okay.
Thanks very much. I'm pleased to be here and talk about some work related to some trials in cancer that I've been working on for the last 10 or 12 years. The setting is patients who've got cancer that's metastasized to the bone, and the lesions in the bone compromise the strength of the bone and put patients at increased risk of fracture, and also cause things like bone pain. And these are bad, adverse events that these trials have been designed to evaluate treatments for preventing. And there are a lot of very interesting statistical problems. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Actuarial Science and specifically interested in biostatistics. And so this is a data analysis part of the title of this workshop. And the interesting problems arise from the fact that you're interested in evaluating a treatment on an event that can recur, but patients are also at high risk of death. So you've got this sort of competing competing risk problem, we call it in statistics, where one type of event can occur or another type of event can occur. And a classical, simple competing risk problem is only one of them can happen at any time. In this context, one can happen multiple times, and that's the fracture, for example, but once death occurs, then that precludes the occurrence of any subsequent fractures. And then how do you evaluate treatment effects on the fracture outcome? So that's one complication. And the other complication is you're following people over time, and people are being withdrawn from the study, either by a physician's decision or a patient's choice. And so the people that you end up with at a particular time point are not necessarily representative of the ones that you started with. So there's a sort of bias that creeps into the data as time passes. And so the question is, again, how do you deal with that in an appropriate way? So to start with it, I'm going to talk about a really simple problem just to illustrate two different strategies you can use. And then we'll get into the methods for the actual motivating clinical trial. And apologize, it's shifted to the left a little bit, but I think you can see everything that's important. So this is a sort of canonical problem where basically we're thinking about just a single follow-up assessment. The general marks regarding missing data. So missing data can arise in longitudinal studies if somebody just misses an assessment. They could actually decide to drop out of the study. Or the design of the study could be such that patients have to leave if certain things happen to them. And you have to be careful in standard analyses because they wouldn't deal with this selection effect, and you would get biased estimates of most things you might be interested in. So here's a canonical example. So you've got a study where individuals are entering, and you might measure some risk factors on them. They could be assigned to treatment, but in this case, let's just say they're followed over time. And after some time point, you measure a response, which is, say, just again, keep it simple, one or zero. One, if an event was experienced, and zero, if no event was experienced. Mm-hmm. These risk factors could be anything. Continuous mixture of categorical. Here, I'm just for illustration talking about a binary. The principles apply, as you'll see, for much more complicated processes than this. But yeah, X could be a large, complex set of characteristics of an individual, and that's a key point, actually, which I'll get to in a second. So when people can withdraw from your study and not provide you with a follow-up assessment, then you actually don't have just a yes or no response, y is equal to 1 or 0. You've got a three-dimensional response, y is 1. And you only know this if the response was observed. So R is indicating a response is available. If the response is available, Y could be zero. But if the response is unavailable, you don't know what Y is. So how do we do the analysis we might be interested in this context? So we really have three different outcomes. So our temptation is to just say, and this is what's sort of routinely done, let's just analyze the data that we've got. If it's missing, it's missing. And so what we really do in that case is we're conditioning, we're evaluating or modeling this conditional probability that y is equal to 1 given r is equal to 1. So is this legitimate is the question. Is this going to be a legitimate estimate of the just the population probability-y is equal to 1. So the key question can be phrased in three different ways. So how similar is the probability of success among those subjects observed and those subjects who were not observed? So is this probability close to or the same as this probability given R is equal to 0, where it's written explicitly in this third point here? Or another way of saying it is, are the people that you're left with like the ones that you started with, or not? So this is just a really simple example, again, to say, where do you run into problems? So you run into problems in this case. So suppose you have sort of two groups of people in the population, or two subpopulations. Say one group for them, x is equal to 1, and they have a low success rate. And you have another group where x is equal to 0, they would have a higher success rate. And let's say half the people have this characteristic, and therefore half of them don't. So you might say patients with a low success rate, the probability y is equal to 1 is equal to 40%, and the probability y is equal to 1 if they don't have this is 80%. So these are like bad performers and these are good performers. Now suppose, in addition, this sort of risk factor is related to whether or not you measure or are able to see them at the second time point. And let's say it's really simple again. So if they have this risk factor, there's a 50% chance they're going to be available. If they don't have it, it's a 100% chance that they're going to be available to measure Y on. So if you just work through the math using Bayes' rule, this is just adding or averaging the probabilities in the population. The true response rate is 60%, but if you restrict attention to the people where it's observed, it's 66%. So this is actually what you're estimating if you just do a complete case analysis. So now the question is, what do we do to address this bias? So there's two approaches that we can use. One is to say, let's develop a more complete model for our response. So we're going to actually set a model that models probability of success given we're restricting attention to the people with complete data, but we're also conditioning on this risk factor. And if we condition on this risk factor, then the availability, whether the data is available or not, is independent of the response, and so we're actually getting a legitimate estimate of this quantity here. So what we've done is we've conditioned on a risk factor that renders the response independent of the missingness. But the problem with this is we've abandoned our original objective of just estimating this population response. So you can actually work with this, though, and you can. This expectation operator just says average over the possible values for this covariate, this conditional probability, and you're going to get back this population average probability that you're interested in. But this is going to require modeling this vector of risk factors that individuals have. So we are doing something here we don't normally like to do, and that is specifying a very high-dimensional model for patient characteristics. An alternative approach is to say, let's restrict attention to people with complete data. So what I'm doing here is I'm writing down an estimating function, which is going to allow me to estimate this population probability. But I'm restricting attention to people, as I say, who have complete data. So we're summing up over all m individuals we started with, this multiplied by this indicator function. So the only terms that are going to pop in here are the ones for people where we observed y. But what we're doing here is we're scaling this by the probability that they actually were available for this final assessment. And so what we're doing is we're reweighting each person's contribution to this estimating equation so that they represent a larger collection of individuals who you started with who just didn't happen to be available at this follow-up assessment. So we're weighting, reweighting each person's contribution to make them representative of similar people that you started with. So in the first approach, we are modeling this risk factor profile. And in the second approach, we're modeling the probability that they were available for this assessment at the last time point. So those are two approaches that we're going to explore in the context of this cancer trial. And in this cancer trial, we're going to deal with, as I said, fractures that happen repeatedly over time. So I'm just going to give a little preamble on recurrent event processes. And these arise a lot in medical research. You could be talking about exacerbations in patients with asthma or cystic fibrosis, seizures in patients with neurological disorders like epilepsy. In transplant studies, patients can reject the transplanted organ, but they can also experience transient graft rejection episodes that can happen repeatedly. And as I said, in this cancer trial, we're talking about patients with bone metastases. So the events, let's just say they're fractures. So this is a little notationally intensive, but I think I can describe what we're doing here in terms of the example that we just talked about, which was really a little easier. So basically, these are timeline diagrams, and the T's represent the times of events, and T1 is the first event, T2 is the second event, and so on. And C is just some time we're going to stop observing individuals. So we define counting processes here. So N of S is an event process, which you can define just as the sum of the indicators that TK is less than S at any particular time S. And H of S is the collection of information on events that happened over the interval 0 to S. So that includes sort of the number of events and when those events happened. And delta N of T is the number of events that happened in some interval T to T plus delta T. And if we take the limit as delta T goes to 0, then this just becomes an indicator function. Did an event happen at time S or not? So this is our data, and if we want to graph it, we can use time on the x-axis again, and the y-axis would just be N of T, and so 0 until this event, and it jumps up at the second event, and so on, and this process goes on. So we need to think about models for this event process, and one way of thinking about them is in terms of this intensity function. Lambda T, which is the instantaneous conditional probability that an event occurs at time T given the information that was collected up until time T. And we'll show in a second that if we specify intensity functions, we have fully specified the model, and therefore we should be able to write down a likelihood function that we can maximize to get estimates of the quantities we're interested in. I won't go into too much detail here, but basically we're going to partition this interval 0 to C by specifying these cut points, U1 up to UM. And as the number of cut points goes to infinity, their width goes to 0. But as you're approaching 0, an interval will either contain or not contain a particular event. And so our intensity function, according to the definition I just put on the previous slide, is going to define with the additional terms vanishing more rapidly than as delta U goes to 0, the probability of an event in a particular interval, or the probability of no events in a particular interval. So this is just a binary, yes, an event occurred, or no, an event did not occur process now. And so to get our likelihood function, we likelihood functions are defined as being proportional to the probability of observing the data that you observe. So we need to write down this probability. And here we're just going to write it down as a sequence of conditional probabilities. And we use this product integral notation here, which just says, well, let's think of it as a discrete time problem and take the limit as n goes to infinity. And we'll get a probability for the actual events that were observed and when they were observed. And that's going to define this, what we call a likelihood function here. So the point of this slide is just saying if you specify a likelihood function, or sorry, if you specify an intensity function, you can write down a likelihood function, and you can maximize that likelihood function to get estimates of the parameters indexing this intensity, which characterizes the process. So that's discussed in the context of the situation where everybody is observed over this interval 0 to C. Well, people, as I mentioned, drop out of these studies, and so not everybody has the same C, so we need to deal with that. I'm going to go through this and then a couple of technical slides, and then I'll go to the example so you can see how it works in practice. Basically, though, think of C now as another random quantity. Now we have two things that are random, the fracture occurrence and when people drop out of the study. And so to write down our likelihood function now, we need to think of the joint distribution of the observed events in this observable counting process. So this random censoring time just determines this indicator function, which says, are people at risk or not at time S? Well, if S is less than the censoring time, then this is 1. If it's bigger than the censoring time, this turns into 0. And so when I multiply this by this indicator function, this now counts only observed events, not the events that happen after the person dropped out of the study. So now our history includes both event occurrence and the observation indicator. And our likelihood function now has to be proportional to the joint probability of the events I observed and this indicator of whether somebody dropped out of the study or not. And to make a long story short, as long as I condition on enough information in the history of this process, I can do analyses based on the intensity function of the underlying process. So I'm using bars to indicate quantities that are observed, and if there's no bar, then it's the process that I'm actually interested in. So this lambda bar is the intensity for the observable recurrent event process, and this lambda is the intensity function for the underlying process. So there's two things going on. There's an underlying process, and if we could observe everybody perfectly, we could model that. But we don't observe people perfectly because they drop out of our study, and so we have a different model potentially for what we're seeing than what we're really interested in. And so that's what the bars are doing. They're distinguishing those two processes, observable, possibly not observable. Now, the nice thing about this is if we condition on enough of the past, then we can write this intensity just as some indicator function times the intensity of the underlying process. So the question is, how much do we have to condition on in the history in order to render this property valid? So the problem with this whole approach is in clinical trials, you do not want to do any conditioning on the history. You don't want to specify conditional models for risks of events where you're conditioning on the past. So the reason is, if you want to evaluate a treatment effect, you want to be able to get an estimate of a quantity that you can tell a physician, if you give this patient this drug, this is what you can expect to happen, compared to if you give them this drug. That's kind of a marginal or an unconditional or sort of average statement where you're not saying, you know, if this particular patient has this sequence of events then what can I expect this treatment effect to be? So it's a difference between a conditional probability and an unconditional probability. So for the purpose of evaluating treatment effects, we want unconditional probability. So this, for example, mu t is a mean function, which just tells you the average number of events experienced by an individual over time. There's no conditioning here whatsoever. So I'm just thinking of a one-sample problem. So this is going to be an increasing function, right? As time increases, you can't reduce the number of events, but it can stay the same, but it's on average, it's going to go up. This is a rate function, so it's the derivative of the mean function, which tells you sort of the instantaneous risk. But again, it's not conditional on the history. So it's not an intensity function. It's a unconditional expectation for the number of events. So these equations look like the equations we had before for that simple example with the single response at the end of follow-up. At time t, what we're trying to do here is get an estimate for the rate function, the risk of events at time t. So what we do is we take the data, this indicator function, and we subtract its expectation, and we're going to sum this up over all people, but we can only do this at time t among people who have not yet been censored. So this is going to render this estimate of a rate, which is just the total number of events observed at time t divided by the total number of people at risk at time t. And we can integrate that to get an estimate of this expectation. And this is called the Nelson-Allen estimate. So it's just an integrated rate. And then this is the slide that points out that this is not a legitimate estimating equation if we have concerns about dependence between this event process and the censoring process. So we're going to get biased estimates, just like when we went from a 60% probability to a 66% probability in that previous example. Similar biases will arise if this condition is not satisfied. So if withdrawal from the study is not completely independent of the event process. So now we have to think about approaches for dealing with this. Well, one approach is to model the censoring process, which is like when we talked about modeling whether R was 1 or not. You model the dropout process. Or we can develop a more complete model for this recurrent event process and then average to get this unconditional expectation. And that's like where we fit a regression model conditioning on the risk factors the patient had and then average over those risk factors. So just like previously when we had a weight that we defined, previously it was the probability R is equal to 1 given X. Now I have a weight here that I'm introducing into the estimating equations for this rate function. And if this is correctly specified, then that's going to render this estimating equation legitimate, and we can get consistent estimates for the rate that we're interested in. And so I won't go into all the details here, but basically we need to model this process, and this will then give us what we call a weighted Nelson-Allen estimate. So the question is, how do you do that? And so we're going to do it in such a way that we're modeling the probability of dropout. So this is the rate of dropping out from the study. So there's a superscript C here for censoring, given the history of the process, right? And so this history contains, as I said, information on the number and times of events up until time t. And here what we're saying is, let's suppose it just depends on the number of events they've experienced, right? So the risk of withdrawing from the study or being pulled from the study just depends on how many events have been experienced, right? So I can just now put a J on this and call this a sort of event-specific withdrawal rate. And I can estimate it in a natural way, which just says, well, how would I estimate that? I would say, okay, let's look at all the people that are alive and on study and have had J events. So those are all the people that are at risk, and then some of them are ones who actually are going to withdraw at time t. That ratio is an estimate of that rate. And with that estimate, we can plug that into this expression and get an estimate for G. So that's approach one. Model the censoring process. Like in the previous example, model the dropout process. Approach two is to say, well, let's specify a Markov model. Instead of just estimating a rate that's not conditional on anything, let's estimate rates of transitions that are different depending on how many events an individual has experienced. So this multi-state diagram means, okay, that if you're in here, you've had no events. If you're in here, you've had one event. And you're at risk of a transition into here because you're at risk for your second event. And this quantity here is just that transition rate. So now our problem is to estimate these transition rates. And I won't go into all the details. Basically, we can do this by specifying a transition intensity matrix, you know, and these intensities are just the transition probabilities at a particular instant. And if we integrate them, we get capital A. And then given this transition intensity matrix, we can estimate this transition probability matrix where this has JK element probability YT equals K given Y S equals J. So we're modeling this process, which is now much more complicated, but we're doing it because it's important to do some conditioning on this process to render the withdrawal process independent of the observation process. So you can go through this and estimate the transition rates in this very natural way. Again, this is just saying, if I want to estimate the rate of movement from state K to state K plus 1, I take all the people who are in state K, and I have some fraction of them who actually made a move from K to K plus 1, and I can plug this into this matrix and get an estimate of this transition probability. Well, basically, I want to get, if I take one, this is an identity matrix, so 1 plus this is like the probability of not making a move from 0 into 1. And so I can do one of two things when I'm in state 0, stay in state 0, which is going to be 1 minus that, or make a move. Yeah. So I'm going to get an estimate of this. Now the question is, why did I do this, and what am I going to do with it? Well, interestingly enough, we're interested in methods that don't really rely on model assumptions, if at all possible, and it turns out that this Allen Johansson estimate for this transition probability matrix is a non-parametric estimate, which is consistent for the true transition probability matrix, irrespective of whether the Markov assumption is true or not. So this is only discovered in 2001 by Allen et al. And Data and Satin. Allen being the guy who developed it in the first place. So that's very important because we don't want to have our analyses hinge on assumptions we're not confident are true. And the other thing is we can use this matrix. If we take the first row of this transition probability matrix, I can compute this expectation in a completely different way than what I did before. I just take K multiplied by the probability that an individual is in state K at time T and sum it up over all possible values of K, and that's the definition of a mean. It's just an average. So we call these partially conditional models because they do condition on something in the history, and all it is the number of events that have been experienced up until that time point. And we can extend these models and introduce weights if we want to. Here's another interesting alternative way of doing the same thing. An alternative approach is to say, if I want to estimate the probability somebody's actually got, say, two events at a particular time, T, I should calculate the probability that they've had two events, and I should subtract the probability they've had three events. So if you've had two and you haven't had three, you must still have two. So this is another way of estimating this transition probability function. And these script Fs we just used to describe survivor functions. And so now we have another way of doing that. And we can then appeal to this formula here again with a new estimate for P0K at time t. So this is a simulation study I'll talk about briefly. We have a stochastic process here designed to reflect what happens in these studies, right? So E0 means you've had no events of interest, like no fractures. You make a transition to E1, you've had your first fracture. That transition rate is denoted by lambda 0. But before you had your first event, you could have been withdrawn from the study. So a transition from E0 to C0 means you were censored before you had your first event. You could have had, say, your first event and then a second event and then been censored. So C2 represents the state you enter if you withdraw after your second event. We can relate these censoring rates to each other by specifying this multiplicative effect here. So what this says is the risk of withdrawal increases by some factor C with each event you experience. So if you've had K events, it's C to the K times gamma 0. So if C is equal to 1, it says there's no relationship between your event process and your censoring process because all of these transition rates are the same. If C is bigger than 1, which happens in practice, it says with each occurrence of an event, your risk increases of withdrawal. And that's important because doctors want to pull people off studies oftentimes when bad things start to happen to them to give them alternative treatment, which is good for the patient, but it's not so good if you're trying to analyze the data that's left. Right? So the other parameters here are for the transition intensity. These are the event occurrence. And we adopt a similar structure here where with each event, the risk for the next event goes up by some factor E. So if E is 1, it turns out this reduces to what we call a Poisson process. And if E is bigger than 1, it's just a more general Markov process where risk, again, for future events increases with the occurrence of each event. And this is just a sort of a results of a simulation study where we're seeing the biases from naive analyses, which ignore the fact that we've got dependent censoring. So we've said, let's generate data according to that multi-state diagram and analyze it in a variety of ways, one of which is just the simple Nelson-Allen estimate, one of which is AJ stands for Allen Johansson estimate, which is the one based on the Markov model. And the Pepe estimate is the one where we take the difference in the survival probabilities. And you see that the naive methods generate very large biases in the estimates of the mean functions, and the biases get bigger as time passes because more people are dropping out of the study. If we do something to try and correct for that by introducing weights, for example, then the biases are negligible. If, in fact, we contemplate all of these different methods here, and there is completely independent censoring, so it's unnecessary to do any of the more sophisticated analyses, we see the biases are all negligible again. And this is just for different kinds of models, a semi-Markov rather than Markov model. The last thing I'll talk about is generalizations, because in reality, as I mentioned in this cancer trial we'll look at in a second, the mortality rate is quite large, right? So they're very sick patients. So the state D0, D1, D2 is analogous to these censoring states or withdrawal states, but they correspond to death. So phi0 is the mortality rate for people who've had no events, and phi3 is the mortality rate, say, for people who've had 3 events. And so in addition to having dependent censoring, we have dependent mortality or dependent termination process. So this says if D is equal to 1, there's no relationship between event occurrence and mortality. And if D is bigger than 1, there's a problem because not only do you potentially have dependent censoring, you've also got a dependence between the death process and the recurrent event process. And so I won't go into all the details here, but these are just extensions of what we'd what we talked about before, where you just get a direct estimate, you estimate a transition probability matrix using a Markov model, or you look at the differences in the survival distributions. Now, what's interesting here is a couple things. So now what we're doing is we're looking at the bias and the estimate of the expected number of events at the end of follow-up. And a couple interesting things. If you look at the case where there's a dependent censoring, the bias is quite large for the Nelson-Allen estimate, the naive approach. And the standard error is 0.103. So that's the precision of our biased estimate. If we weight, so the W means introduce the weight, the bias goes to something close to zero. And the standard error has gone up a little bit here. If we look at the Markov model, a completely different approach for trying to tackle this problem, the bias is negligible, even if we don't weight, because we're generating data where this model is actually true. But also note that the standard error here is very close to the standard error of this weighted Nelson-Allen estimate. So the key thing is, two key things. One, if the model is misspecified because you're ignoring this dependent withdrawal, these are the biases you're going to see. If you correct for that, whether you use the multi-state approach or the inverse weighting approach, the standard errors are very, very similar, and broadly similar conclusions you can see in the other two tables. So let's get to this example. So we're looking at patients who have been diagnosed with cancer, and at some point they've developed bone metastases. And once bone metastases develop, then they become at risk for these skeletal events, which we'll just say, for simplicity, are fractures. But they actually, it's a composite endpoint, which includes things like bone pain and need for surgery and elevation of markers in the blood that indicate really bad bone activity. And then death. And so people are going to be recruited for these trials between onset of bone metastases and death. And sometimes there's a requirement that they've had a fracture, and sometimes there's a requirement that they haven't had a fracture. So it's a multi-center trial. This one in particular, the breast cancer patients, almost 200 people in each group. So this pimidronate is the drug that's designed to strengthen the bone, but it's not expected to affect survival. And placebo is the control. And we've got 2 years of follow-up. And so the diagram, this diagram here, actually characterizes exactly what's going on in this trial. They start out with no events. They might have an event. They might be censored. They might have another event or die. And this is a schematic for 10 randomly sampled individuals from the two treatment arms. This is the experimental arm, and this is the placebo. And the length of these lines, actually, I don't have the length of, or the x-axis here, but 2 years is about here, right? So the length of the lines indicate how long they were on study, and so it could be shortened because of death or withdrawal, and the dots indicate the times of fractures. So we actually have almost 200 lines like this, and almost 200 lines like this. And in this arm, you can see there's more dots, and they occur closer in time for any individual, typically. It would be about 2 years would be out about here. So some people withdrew, you know, around 6 months. These guys made it to almost 2 years. So what we want to do for the purpose of figuring out whether this treatment's any good is we want to figure out a way of comparing almost 200 of these lines to almost 200 of these lines and making a decision, does treatment help people or not? So one of the things we're going to do is we're going to look at what we call cumulative intensities. So the intensity or the transition rate at a particular time point tells you the risk of something happening to them, right? The problem is that varies very dramatically from time to time. So what we'll do instead is we integrate those rates And then we get lines we can plot, and we can look at the slope. So the slope of these lines tells us about the trend in the rate. And so this red line here is the integrated transition rate from no events to one event. Right? So the slope of that line is like an estimate of alpha t, little alpha t. The slope of this line is an estimate of little alpha 1, which is the rate of going from one event to two events. And this is for 2 to 3. So when we look at these, we compare the slopes and we say, well, the risk of the second event is higher than the risk of the first event. If you've got a person you're looking at, say, at 1 year, and they haven't had an event yet, the slope of this line characterizes the risk of their event. If you got another person at 12 months who's had one event, the slope of that line characterizes their risk. So this slope's bigger than this slope, so this person who's had one event is at greater risk than the one who hasn't had any events. So this is telling us it's probably not a Poisson process, it might be a Markov process. Now we can do the same thing and look at transition intensities or integrated transition intensities for death. So the red line here is the integrated transition from E0 to D0. It's the mortality cumulative transition rate for people who've had no events. And this is for one event, and this is for two events. There aren't as many deaths here, but broadly speaking, you can see these lines are getting increasingly steeper. So that's telling us there's a relationship between how many events you've had and your risk of death, which is not entirely surprising. And then the one that is what motivated all of this work is censoring. So if we look at the transitions into the censoring states, we have, for the red line, it's the people who have had no events. We're looking at their integrated rate of censoring. One event, two events, and again, it's even more obvious here that there's increasing risk of censoring with each event occurring. These are estimated state occupancy probabilities. So if we're interested in estimating the probability that an individual, nothing happens to them, that's this line here, and we've got three different methods of estimating that. If we're interested in estimating the probability somebody's had actually one event, it starts out at zero, it increases, and then it decreases as people die or have subsequent events, and we can repeat this over time. And lastly, if we're interested in estimating the mean functions, the expected number of events over time since they entered the study, the expected number of fractures, then we've got six different methods of dealing with this, and we get six quite different plots. But broadly speaking, if we're waiting, you can see there's a cluster of estimates around here. If we make an attempt to wait to deal with dependent withdrawal, then our estimates tend to coincide more closely than if we ignore the problem of dependent censoring, where we can get quite wildly different estimates. It's the same thing for the treatment comparison or the treatment arm. Now here, the expected number of events is fewer, so the problem of dependent censoring is less, because fewer people have more events and therefore experience this increased risk of withdrawal because of the effective treatment. Oh, okay, I guess that's my last slide, so I'll stop there. But basically, this is an example of clinical trial data where patients withdraw from the study, and that creates problems. And this is happening by chance. But in other studies, as I said, it could be driven by the protocol, so it could be part of the design. And in that case, pharmaceutical companies are often shooting themselves in the foot because they're getting sort of underestimates of the effect of their treatment by pulling the people out of the study who are experiencing the most events. And you're doing that for the benefit of the patients, And so I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm saying if you do that, then you should make an adjustment and get estimates of treatment effects which are maybe more accurate and more reflective of reality. So I'll stop there. But thanks for your attention.